Now, Joey O'Callaghan was just 18 years old when he became the youngest ever person to be signed up to the Witness Protection Programme. Well, in her new book entitled Witness, our first guest today tells his story. Welcome to the show, Nicola Tallant.
Thank you.
Very welcome, Nicola. This poor child, I've been reading about him. First of all, where are we talking about? Where was he born and raised?
Well, he was born in Dublin and he was raised in quite an impoverished area of the city, which would have been gripped in the 1980s when he was, you know, a young child with a heroin epidemic. So his father was an alcoholic. And he beat his mother. He didn't have a great start in life, to be honest with you. He was, you know, he wasn't dealt the best hand of cards when it came to that. But his mother, nonetheless, worked very hard, saved money, and moved her family out of the area and into another part of Dublin where she hoped they'd get a fresh start. And unfortunately, it was there that a cataclysmic series of events happened that would change his life forever.
Yeah, a bit ironic really, isn't it? She tried to do the right thing and actually made it worse without meaning to.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. So when he was there, he was at home from school one day basically, and he opened the door. There was a milkman standing there, and he was looking to speak to his mother, who wasn't in. They had a bit of a conversation, and he sort of cheekily asked him could he have a job on the milk float. At the time, back then, kids used to, you know, run around for the milkman, collect money at the doors and deliver the bottles in the mornings. And they'd be, you know, given a little weekend job or whatever. He was only 12 at the time. And the milkman said, yes, you can have a job at the weekends. Come and start on Thursday. And he did. He was delighted with himself, made a little bit of pocket money. But unfortunately, that the milk round was being used as cover for a drug operation. And the milkman, a man called Brian Kenny, would go on to become one of the biggest drug dealers here in Dublin of the time. And, you know, slowly he groomed Joey into his gang. He got him to deliver heroin through the doors, along with leaving the milk bottles on the doors and delivering the heroin through the letterboxes. And he terrorised him and sort of cut him off from his family very quickly in a similar sort of style of grooming that you'd often hear paedophiles using. Yeah. I often find from my job that drug dealers can often, you know, do the same, take the same methods with kids.
Yeah, and it wasn't just a little bit of coke or heroin, was it? It was up to 300 bags a day. I mean, that's crazy.
Yeah, I mean, it was a big operation he had, and he was building it and building it. He was a very ambitious drug dealer. He wanted to be, you know, one of the major players here in Dublin at the time. And heroin, he saw as the 24/7 drug. I suppose it's addictive. People take it because they have to. They'll do anything they can to buy it. So it was kind of his bread and butter, and the cocaine, which was coming along as well, was something that it would sell well during the week and then experience a boom at the weekend when people went out. So he was benefiting from both those drugs. And, you know, he was robbing. He schooled Joey in gangland, really, and, you know, brought him further and further into his dark world.
And did Joey, as you often hear in these sort of situations, start taking drugs himself?
Well, actually, Brian Kenny fed him cocaine because he used to, in the early days when Joey was still living at home with his mother, and she was of the opinion that he was just working on this milk round, and that Brian Kenny was quite a kindly father figure to him. He was a very manipulative character, but when he was still living at home, he'd go to school in the morning and he'd sign in, and then he'd slip out the back where Brian Kenny would be waiting for him with spare clothes, a few lines of cocaine, and the drugs he wanted him to sell in the flats. So he put him on the coke very early on to give him, I think, probably that bit of courage to go and do what he wanted him to do. When they were on robberies and stuff together, he'd also load him up on cocaine to get his adrenaline going. you know, so he would be more useful to him, really. So he was on a cocktail of drugs from a very young age, and they were fed to him.
I'm imagining until 2004, which we'll talk about very shortly, but he was probably too frightened to go against him at that point.
He was terrified of him. There was a number of reasons for that, but in particular, there was one night very early on when Joey was still quite a young child. He was only 12 or 13 at the time. He was on the milk float one evening, and Brian Kenny suddenly saw another van on the road, and he pulled in. And he reached under the seat where he had a hammer, and he jumped out of the van before Joey knew what was happening, and ran over to the other van he'd seen, and pulled a young teenager from the side of the van and started to beat him savagely with this hammer. He dragged him into a garden, and Joey could hear the screams of this teenager that sort of, you know, ended up nearly in a whimper. He could hear the bones breaking, the hammer coming down on his body over and over again, and it was terrifying. It would much later be identified actually as the moment that Joey suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder. It would be brought back, his post-traumatic stress disorder, which was much later on diagnosed, was actually linked to that.
I'm not
that terrifying beating.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. I mean, that would be horrifying for any of us. But for a young lad, I mean, oh, it doesn't bear thinking about, does it? He shouldn't have witnessed anything like that.
No, and Kenny also had weapons. He had guns, and he would often, you know, put them in Joey's mouth. He would put them to his head. He would threaten him. He was a terrifying, terrifying individual that was capable of anything. And he held him really within his world, with a mix of that fear for himself and also with threats of what he would do to the rest of Joey's family, to his sisters, to his mother. He was always dropping little comments in about how he would burn their house down, or he'd plant drugs in the sisters' cars and all this. So he was a really, really nasty individual.
He certainly was. It's shocking. And then tell us what happened in 2004, because then there was actually a murder, wasn't there?
Yeah, I mean, you know, as I say, Brian Kenny was a very ambitious drug dealer. And as the years went on, he just started mixing in bigger drug circles and, you know, would have been trying to link up with a gang across the city. He got into cahoots with another drug dealer called Thomas Hinchin, and they started to spend a lot of time together, do a lot of business together. One day, Joey, who was 17, 18 at the time, was at home in the house that Brian Kenny owned. And the two of them came back on a motorbike, and they were very stressed out. They got off the bike and they handed Joey the leathers. They told him to burn the torch, the bike. And then Brian Kenny handed him a gun, and he told him to go and bury it in the field out the back of the house. And Joey knew something shocking had happened. He turned on the news, and within an hour it had been reported that there had been a 24-year-old man murdered, shot dead outside a prison in Dublin. He'd been sitting in a car. Two men on a motorbike had approached and riddled his body with bullets and made their escape. So that was Kenny and Hinchin, and they had given Joey the weapon that had been used to kill this young man. So for him, I think this was a moment of awakening nearly. He realised that this situation he was in was terrifying on a number of levels. He was being asked to, you know, cover up a murder. He was living at that point with a killer. And he always really had this moral compass, to be honest with you. He never lost that, despite the kind of the darkness of the world he was living in. For him, murder was absolutely outside the realms of what was okay. He escaped. He went back to his mother initially and, you know, told her what had happened, asked for her advice. She said to him, you know, you need to do the right thing and you need to go and tell the guards who was responsible for this chap's death. And that's what he did. And as you can imagine, within that world, that underworld, that is the ultimate sin.
Yeah.
To break the code of Omerta, to tout, to rat. They have all sorts of language for it. There's no coming back from that.
And, I mean, brave, if he happens to be listening, then very, very brave young man to have done that, because I can't imagine how scared he must have felt. But he must have also worried that he was then putting his mum in danger as well.
Well, and everybody around him. I mean, he was in such a catch-22 situation, you know, stay and die, but leaving was nearly a more dangerous position for him to have taken, because he had to give evidence against them in court. It wasn't okay just to lead the guards to the gun and, you know, the other evidence, but he would have to give evidence in a court of law and hope that he'd be believed. So he was signed up to the State's Witness Protection Programme. Most European countries have similar. We, as a society, ask people to come forward and give evidence. We've a robust justice system, which, you know, people are innocent until proven without reasonable doubt, particularly in murder. So he was placed on that programme, which meant he was protected. He was moved from safe house to safe house in Ireland and outside the jurisdiction as well. And as the trial date was looming, he was looking at having to give evidence against them, facing them down in court, the two men he was probably most terrified of in the world. And he did do that. He gave evidence, and both of them pleaded not guilty to the murder of Jonathan O'Reilly and not guilty to threatening to kill Joey. On both counts, they were found guilty by a jury who believed Joey's evidence. They believed he was a truthful witness.
Thank goodness for that. Did they get life?
They both got life, but that was back in 2005. And like many systems, life doesn't mean life. Just as Joey is emerging now from you know, a lot of trauma, and he had difficulty after his time on the witness protection program, he's remained terrified for his life. But as he sort of continues to serve that life sentence, albeit in the free world, Kenny has been given parole and is now in an open prison, due for release over the next few years. So their sentence is coming to an end, just really as Joey's getting his life together now.
Oh, that's terrible. And we're talking two decades on. Was it the 80s or 90s? I can't remember.
It was 2004 when
Not
that far back, really.
16 years, yeah.
This is what life is, you see. This is what life in prison is. It's really just, 15, 16 years is an average life sentence.
I don't know why they call it life. So, it's pointless,
yeah,
isn't it?
I know. It is a bit. That's for sure. It is. But, you know, some of them will serve longer. It's a complex system here. I know in the UK and in Spain as well, it can be complex. I think actually in the UK, people serve half a sentence.
Yeah.
Guaranteed. And here they get, guaranteed 25% off. Despite their behaviour behind bars, it does seem quite senseless, really.
Yeah, outrageous. And of course, poor Joey sort of received his own life sentence being in the Witness Protection Programme.
Almost definitely. I mean, look, he was terribly young, and he was 19 when he was given a new identity, and he was to start life afresh in a new country, without any contact with anybody he'd ever known previous or with his family, which is the nature of the Witness Protection Programme. It's quite a savage thing to have to go on. But, he was given a new identity, a new name, a new backstory, everything. But he just did not have the skills really to live on his own. And he had been through a lot of trauma with Kenny. He had been physically and sexually abused for years by him, and you know, his childhood had been taken. He probably would have needed a lot of psychological care before he was sent out into the world on his own. But I mean, that's part of his story in the book, The Witness. I suppose that's the other half of the story, how he got on after all that.
Yeah.
You know, and how he is now.
And let's hope that there'll be another story in 10, 15 years' time to say that he got his life together and was safe.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, look, he's doing well at the moment. And I mean, for him, it was an important story to tell. He feels that, you know, he's a lot of regrets, I'm sure. And many of them are centred around the beginning of his story, when he didn't look for help, when he didn't seek help, when he didn't tell anybody what was happening to him. And really, I think his hope is that maybe his story might sort of awaken somebody else who's finding themselves been drawn into that world. And
yeah,
you know, maybe
let's hope so.
Maybe, you know.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, let's hope so. And do you think he felt, or did you feel in writing his story, that he had support? I mean, the witness protection program is one thing, but did he get help? Did he get support from anyone, or was he just put, you know, from safe house to safe house?
He would be very critical about the witness protection program and his treatment after it, there's no doubt. He only really got proper help in recent years after eventually pushing and pushing with the management of the Garda Síochána here. It was eventually agreed that he could go for therapy to the Priory in the UK, where he stayed for a year, where he was diagnosed with a series of illnesses or ailments, none of which he was born with, all of which dated back to his time with Kenny and his time in the Witness Protection Programme, between the post-traumatic stress disorder I spoke to you about earlier, you know, serious anxiety that he has to live with. I mean, he's never going to be fixed. The fact of the matter is he will always have to live very cautiously and carefully, and he will always have to have you know, be on a different level to most of us can go through life without worrying too much about having the doors locked 10 times at night to make sure they're actually locked. He will have to live like this forever, but it's to be able to cope with the anxieties and the stresses and to, you know, to limit them as much as he can. That's what he garnered from his time in the Priory. And, you know, unfortunately, he feels that had he got that therapy and that help earlier, he wouldn't have suffered more following the trials of Hinchin and Kenny.
Yeah.
You know, he feels he did a lot when he stood up to them as such a young guy, and he feels let down really by the state.
Yes,
he feels
I'm
as
sure.
if he did a job he was asked to do, and then he was cast aside. That's really how he feels.
Yeah, it was probably, you know, they were probably all over him when they needed him to give evidence, but as soon as it was done, it sounds like that was it.
Yeah, and I think that is the nature of the Witness Protection Programme. I mean, we, you know, can't be under any illusion about it, but a lot of people who go on witness protection are much more robust individuals. A lot of them have been involved in criminality themselves for a long time. They might be a little bit more streetwise, and the idea of a new life away from everything they knew before is exactly what they need. Whereas Joey was just younger and more damaged, I think, than others. And maybe the programme maybe wasn't ready for him. And hopefully the programme itself has learned something from his story.
Yes, let's hope so. One final question, Nicola. I am aware you're an award-winning investigative journalist, but how did the book come about? Did you actually meet him?
I did. I was working on stories around the Witness Protection Programme 10 years ago. And I was aware that Joey had given evidence. I was aware that he was on the programme, that he was only young. And I wondered how he was and how he'd got on. And I didn't quite go looking for him, but I came into contact with his mother. And some years after that, we met for the first time. He was in a very bad way when we met. He was very frightened. He'd actually been beaten up. He'd returned to Dublin, unable to live where he had been relocated. He had been beaten up on the street, recognised. He was really terrified. And you know, we kept in touch for a long time. He moved back out of Ireland again. We kept in touch, and his story was a long time coming, shall we say. But when he wanted to do it, I decided I'd do it with him, knowing him, and we had a good relationship, good sense of trust between us. And I had initially written it as myself. I wrote the book as me telling the story. And halfway through it, I ripped it up and I started again. And I let Joey tell the story in his words. And I think that makes it more powerful. It's bringing the reader right into the world with him. You know, you're getting a ringside seat in gangland, in that world that we don't usually, you know, that's usually secretive. And it's you know, that it was the right decision to have made.
Yes.
Anybody who writes will tell you that is like a nightmare scenario, having to start again. But it was the right thing to do, and I think it's probably made the book come alive.
Yeah, I think you've done him proud. I really do. It's the sort of thing that if you saw this in a film, you'd think, oh, yeah, well, it's a bit far-fetched. That wouldn't really happen. But it actually is true. It's all true.
I often find that fact is often stranger than fiction.
Yeah, and scarier sometimes as well.
Absolutely.
Well, listen, Nicola, if you are in touch with him, tell him I think he's a very, very brave person, and I really hope he goes on to live a good life, a long and good life. The book is called The Witness. It's by Nicola Tallant, who we're speaking to now, and we're selling it right now on our website. Nicola, well done for sharing his story, and thank you for being on the show with us today.
Thank you, Selena.
My pleasure. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.